The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Larkin, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Today is February 17th, 2021. We have five cases on our calendar today, two oral cases and three non-oral cases. We are hearing the oral cases on the Zoom platform in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The first case on our calendar today is A20-1083, Joseph Walsh, Don Lorge versus State of Minnesota. The same procedural rules apply to this Zoom oral argument as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. As you can see, the time is being kept in one of the grid screens by the marshal. The clock will start when you start your oral argument. And if there are any technological issues, we will stop the clock so that you are allotted your full time. The oral argument is being recorded today by the Court of Appeals. Any other recordings of this oral argument are not permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. I'll ask counsel to please identify yourself and the party you represent when you start your argument. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Scott Flaherty of the firm Taft, Stettinius & Hollister, on behalf of Joe Walsh and arguing for both appellants. Minnesota statute grants indemnification to employees of the state and defines the term employee of the state to include persons acting on behalf of the state in an official capacity. When the district court dismissed appellant's complaint for indemnification, it made three errors. First, it imposed a heightened pleading standard requirement inconsistent with Minnesota law. It's enough under Minnesota pleading law that a plaintiff put the defendant on notice of the claim. The complaint at issue here did that when the complaint alleged that Walsh and Lorge acted on behalf of the state in an official capacity. The district court's second error was in applying its own improper heightened pleading requirement. The district court order on appeal here suggested that appellants didn't explain in their complaint how they acted on behalf of the state. That is simply a misreading of the complaint. In addition to affirmatively alleging that Walsh and Lorge acted on behalf of the state, the complaint included specific examples regarding how they did so. So the district court's second mistake was misapplying its own heightened pleading standard. And finally, the district court didn't grapple with the text of the relevant statute, which defines employee of the state. That is section 3732, subdivision 1, subpart 2. The test in that statute is a functional one. A person is entitled to indemnification if they act on behalf of the state. The district court read that statute as imposing a different question, or actually asked a different question. The district court's inquiry was not a functional one consistent with the statute, but was a geographic one. The district court held that Walsh and Lorge were not entitled to indemnification because their duties were local. And the question of where duties are performed and on whose behalf those duties are performed are very different questions. The statute focuses on the functional question.
Mr. Flaherty, before we go too deep into the statutes, I just have a pretty basic question. Since we are dealing with the construction of some statutes here, is the statute section 3.732, the statute that defines state, an ambiguous statute? And likewise is section 46601, the statute concerning municipalities. Is that ambiguous as well? What's your position on that?
We don't believe there is any ambiguity relevant to this appeal, either in chapter 3 or in chapter 466. The district court certainly didn't find ambiguity, and appellants are not seeking any ambiguity or construction on appeal. Our position is that the language, both in Chapter 3 and in Chapter 466, is quite plain and simple, and flexible. The statute appears to contemplate kind of a fact-based inquiry, and perhaps in some other case there might be confusion or uncertainty as to whether someone was or was not acting on behalf of the state. But of course, when it's an attorney who appears in court for the state, or when it's a sheriff who's executing writs issued by a judge of the state, this is not such a close case. But to answer your question, we don't believe there's any ambiguity.
Mr. Flaherty, if I may follow up on Judge Gaitis's question, then, so you agree that the term state is unambiguous and the as defined in 3.732, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
And to be an employee of the state, or as you phrased it, a person acting on behalf of the state, you're focusing on that part of the definition of employee of the state, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So to be a person acting on behalf of the state, you would have to be acting on behalf of the state as defined in paragraph one of section 3.732. Correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And state includes each of the departments, boards, agencies, commissions, courts, and officers in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the state. And then the definition goes on to list a variety of state entities, and specifically then states, provides that it does not include a county. So did appellants allege that they were acting on behalf of a board, department, agency, or other entity included within the definition of state?
Not a department, board, agency, or commission. The complaint alleges at addendum page 17 that Walsh acted on behalf of the state, and the subsequent page alleges the same at addendum page 18 for Walsh.
I'm sorry, Mr. Flaherty, then to allege a claim for defense and indemnification within the meaning of the statute, don't you need to allege that they are acting on behalf of one of the entities that is included within the definition of state?
No, Your Honor, because if you look at the very second word under subpart one of subdivision one, it defines state as including the things listed. So it's not only the things listed. And the definition of state as including certain specific things shouldn't be interpreted to exclude the state itself. So the way to read subdivision one, subpart one, is that the state is the state, as well as departments, boards, agencies, commissions. So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please continue, Your Honor.
I guess I'm not clear. What do you mean when you say the state is the state, as well as departments, boards, agencies, and commissions, et cetera?
We read subdivision 1.1 as expanding the ordinary definition of the state. So the state isn't simply, for example, a plaintiff party in all criminal cases and in some civil cases, but it includes the other things listed.
But wouldn't the state include its departments, boards, and agencies? Why list those? I guess I'm unclear as to your reasoning.
I mean, I would have to speculate.
I guess what I'm saying is, if the state is the state, why list those specific entities that are, in a normal understanding of the state, clearly included within the scope of the state?
It's, for example, Your Honor, I'm looking at the statute here, and it's not obvious to me that without this definition, the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation is part of the state. I think an argument could be made that without that inclusion of the statute, perhaps it would not be part of the state. So because subdivision one, part one is an expansive, inclusive definition, I think we should treat it as a place the legislature can add things to when they want to make sure there's no confusion about who or what is or is not part of the state. I don't think it was necessary for the legislature to define state to include state. And that's probably why this definition is expansive and inclusive rather than exclusive. So my argument might be different if the statute read state includes only the following and then listed everything in that statute. I think.
But doesn't council, Judge Larkin here with a question, doesn't the statutory language specifically exclude counties? You're arguing it's an inclusive list and it's not limited, but on the other hand, the legislature has specified entities that are excluded from the definition of state, has it not?
Correct, Your Honor. The second sentence is exclusive. The first sentence is inclusive.
So what do we do with that second sentence and county employees?
Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court sort of answered that question in the Andrade case from 1986, which held that if a county itself is seeking indemnification under this act, it must satisfy the definition in Subdivision 1, Part 2 for employee of the state. So one of the lessons from Andrade is that simply because an entity is excluded from Subdivision 1-1 does not therefore mean it is excluded from Subdivision 1-2. So that's the lesson from Andrade.
Well, following up on that, Mr. Flaherty, in Andrade, the county had an express delegation under rule to act on behalf of the state. I'm not aware that there's any delegation in to the county attorney to act on behalf of the state. Are you arguing that there such a delegation exists?
I am, Your Honor, and in fact, the Attorney General's website says such a delegation exists, and it can be found in chapters 388 and 387 of the Minnesota statutes. But the case law seems unambiguous and clear that the power to prosecute crimes is a state power, and the legislature, the state legislature, has decided who gets to exercise that power, when and where. Prosecutions are not done by the county board, and in fact, the county board lacks the power to compel a county attorney to institute or not institute prosecutions, and there's analogous duties for the sheriff as well. Our state system, it may be useful to contrast our state system from the federal criminal system, which is unitary, and all prosecutors in the federal system report to the Attorney General of the United States. Our state system is fundamentally different. County attorneys who are exercising that criminal power delegated to them specifically by the state legislature are not beholden to the county attorney. This is the system we have. It could be different, it could be changed, but until it's changed, county attorneys are using power delegated to them by the state legislature, and the Attorney General's own website says as much.
So, Mr. Flaherty, is your argument that these individuals are both state employees and county employees, and so for the purpose of both indemnification statutes, they satisfied the definition of the party to be indemnified?
That's a question easier to phrase than answer, Your Honor. So I want to take my best at it. In this particular case, yes, we are arguing that the county attorney and the sheriff here were, at least in some instances, as alleged by the band's federal complaint, acting on behalf of the state and on behalf of the county, right? Under a different fact pattern, it might be the case that a person only acts for the county and doesn't come within Chapter 3, or it might be the case that a person only acts for the state and doesn't fall within Chapter 466. But there's no language in either law that makes the two exclusive, and there are examples of where a person can act on behalf of both the state and the county. And so it wouldn't be irrational for the legislature to want to make sure that someone has state indemnification when acting for the state and county indemnification when acting for the county. That's not an unreasonable policy choice.
But just to follow up, so is it your position that at times they were acting on behalf of the county and at times they were acting on behalf of the state, or were they simultaneously acting on behalf of both entities?
In this case, from the band's complaint, the band's complaint appears to arise. Oh, is your question temporal, Your Honor? Am I understanding it correctly? So different times in this case, and I can give you an example. So the overwhelming majority of the band's allegations against these appellants in the federal case stem from their prosecutorial or law enforcement decisions, initiating prosecutions or not, the law enforcement function. That is just a state function. But in other parts of the band's lawsuit, they've also suggested perhaps that they disagreed with the advice that the county attorney gave the county board regarding how to deal with the band. And so in that function, in the function of giving the board advice on how to deal with a counterparty, so to speak, that isn't on behalf of the state, because in that instance, the county attorney's client is the board, but in criminal prosecutions, the client is the state.
So under the circumstances here, though, when were they acting on behalf of the state and when were they acting on behalf of the county?
The appellants here were acting on behalf of the state when they were performing law enforcement functions, prosecuting crimes or choosing not to prosecute crimes, or investigating, transporting prisoners to and from criminal hearings. Though the criminal power is fundamentally a state power, and that's made clear by the House decision from 1971 from the Minnesota Supreme Court. Advising the county board on civil matters would not be a function that's done by someone on behalf of the state.
Mr. Flaherty, what statute gives the county attorney the authority to decide the scope of their jurisdiction to prosecute crimes on behalf of the state?
Can you speak up, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. You argued that they were acting on behalf of the state when they decided which crimes to prosecute and not prosecute. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the federal complaint is that it has to do, the allegations at issue relate to the jurisdictional boundaries of the reservation and the authority to prosecute crimes. Is that correct?
Sort of, Your Honor. I can explain even though my time is up, or I can use
okay.
my 5 minutes.
Well, I'll ask on rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jacob Campion. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The State Tort Claims Act does not cover county attorneys and county sheriffs because the definition of the word state does not include them or the types of claims that are being brought against them in the federal case. If you look at the definitions in 3.732, a person acting on behalf of the state in official capacity is considered an employee of the state for purposes of the State Tort Claims Act. But the analysis does not start and end with that phrase. To determine if you're acting on behalf of the state, you need to look at the definition of the word state. And it's clear in that definition that what the legislature is talking about are the people and entities that make up state government. They say it includes each of the departments, boards, agencies, commissions, courts, and officers in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the state of Minnesota. And then they say it includes, but not limited to, and then it lists other state entities. So to be acting on behalf of the state for purposes of the State Tort Claims Act, you must be acting on behalf of a person or entity in state government, one of the boards, one of the agencies, commissions in the executive, legislative, or judicial branches. And county attorneys and county sheriffs do not qualify. They are not part of state government. Their law enforcement activities and criminal prosecutions are not conducted on behalf of any state official or state agency or state entity. They simply do not satisfy the definition, and that's why the district court correctly dismissed this complaint.
Mr. Campion, I'm just going to ask you a question that I asked Mr. Flaherty, and that is whether these statutes are ambiguous. And I'm wondering because in respondent's brief, there was some time devoted to legislative history, which is something that we wouldn't even get to if we found that the statute was unambiguous. So what is your position with regard to ambiguity here?
Yeah, the state's position is that it's not ambiguous. So you don't need to look at that legislative history. The statute's clear on its face. That was included just to rebut something they wrote in their brief about the legislature intending to cover them both under the Municipal Tort Claims Act and the State Court Claims Act, and then give them the choice of which they wanted to proceed under. So that was just to rebut that argument, because it's just not reflected in the history of the enactment of these two statutory schemes. So the other part of the definition is that the legislature went on to specifically exclude counties from the scope of the State Tort Claims Act. So you can't be acting on behalf of the state if you're acting on behalf of the county, which is what county attorneys and county sheriffs do. They are designated as county officials by the legislature. Their oaths of offices are maintained by the county recorder. Their budget and salaries are set by the county board. They're funded by county tax levies. And the statutes say their compensation for services, their compensation is for services rendered to the county. So they have no connection to state government. The state doesn't hire them, it can't fire them, and it has no control over them. They have complete discretion over how they carry out their local government duties. And this is illustrated in the federal case. You know, if you're acting on behalf of someone, you should be carrying out their wishes. But the position they've taken on the Mille Lacs reservation boundary does not match the state position. So if they were acting on behalf of the state, you should have seen their position change when the state's position changed. The legislature simply did not intend to make the state responsible for the independent actions of local government officials. They provided separately for that in the Municipal Tort Claims Act and directed counties and cities and other local governments to be responsible to defend and indemnify their own people. And this conclusion is reinforced by the practical effects of what ruling for the appellants would mean. This would be a massive shift of responsibility for defending and indemnifying all the county attorneys and their staff, all city attorneys and their staff, all the sheriffs and their staff, and local police departments. That would shift all those cases, their logic, to the state of Minnesota to defend and indemnify and handle those cases. And that's simply not what the legislature intended at all.
Mr. Campion, if I can interrupt, could you address appellant's argument that the word includes isn't meant to limit the definition to the entities listed and includes the state as its own entity, and then by extension that counties act on behalf of the state when they prosecute crimes, county attorneys act on behalf of the state when they prosecute crimes?
Yes, Your Honor. So first on the includes, there are two responses to that. First, if you look at that definition, there are actually two lists. And the first list is introduced with the word includes, and that's the boards, agencies, commissions. And then there's a second list of state entities, and that is introduced with the words includes but is not limited to. And so when the legislature uses different words, the courts presume that they mean different things. So the first list is exclusive despite the use of the word includes, and the second list means something different because of the different words. The second response on the includes portion, are there certain canons of construction, and they're similar but a little bit different. One is that you interpret words in light of the words around them, and then the second says when you're interpreting a general word, it needs to be interpreted consistent with the specific words around it. So if this court is going to be adding words to the statute that aren't there, it needs to be adding things that are similar in kind to what is listed. And what is listed are the portions of state government and state entities, and county attorneys and county sheriffs are not similar to the things that are listed. Turning to your question about criminal prosecutions, again, because the definition is talking about state government and county attorneys and their law enforcement activities are not included in that definition. It really doesn't matter if the state of Minnesota appears in the caption of a criminal case, but I think there are two ways to think about the state of Minnesota. And the first way is the way the legislature is talking about in this definition of the people and entities that make up state government. The second way, and this is what I think is happening in a criminal prosecution, is there's an old tradition that, you know, a crime is committed against the people. It's against society. And so another way to think about the state of Minnesota is just the general public and the people of Minnesota. But that's not what the legislature is talking about in the State Tort Claims Act. When they're talking about the state of Minnesota, they are talking about state government, and county attorneys and county sheriffs aren't part of state government. They're part of county government, and so they're covered by the Municipal State Tort Claims Act.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. I have a question for you, and perhaps it's something that Mr. Flaherty could address on rebuttal as well. I'm looking specifically at the definition, employee of the state, which is in 3.732 subdivision 1, parent 2. Do we agree that that definition is relevant? And then employee of the state is the magic phrase, right? That's what triggers the right to seek indemnification under 3.736 sub 9, correct?
Yes, their claim is based on the persons acting on behalf of the state in an official capacity in that definition.
Okay.
1, 2 is not available.
Oops.
At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. To send a fax, press 4 now. To leave a callback number, press 5.
I have no idea where that is coming from. Can people still hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So what I'm wondering then, I'm looking at the statute and I see in the definition of employee of the state, it includes a district public defender or assistant district public defender in the second or fourth judicial district. Now, it's my understanding that those public defenders are county employees, yet they've been included in the definition of employee of the state. Am I wrong to wonder if that means that there are circumstances where a county employee could be considered an employee of the state for purposes of indemnification, but those circumstances are limited to those described specifically by the legislature in the statute? In other words, that is an inclusive list or an exclusive list.
Yes, Your Honor, the legislature certainly knows how to include other individuals or entities. You see it in the example you gave about public defenders. And I know I don't know the complete history, but there was a transition of some, but maybe not all, public defenders from county to the state. You also see it in the Municipal State Tort Claims Act. There are two statutes in that chapter that says county, that says you're considered an employee of the state under the State Tort Claims Act if these circumstances are met. So the legislature certainly knows how to do this. There's another example when it comes to peace officers, and this is relevant to the sheriff's claim in 3.736 subdivision 9A, it does cover a peace officer, but the circumstances when they are off duty outside of their jurisdiction, making an arrest without a warrant and acting in good faith. So, you know, there's no reason for the legislature to include that if peace officers like sheriffs are already covered, as the appellants claim. So yes, Your Honor, the legislature knows how to do it and does it in a few spots, but they have not done it here with respect to county attorneys or county sheriffs. I'll just use my last few minutes here to talk also just about the types of claims that are being brought in federal court. So the tribe sued them in their official capacity. And when you sue a county official in their official capacity, it's just another way of pleading a claim against the county. And that rule, that is a pleading rule. It's not, as appellant claims, a 1983 rule. You know, if you look at their brief in federal court, the cases they're citing are all 1983 cases. It just comes up in 1983 a lot because that's the most common type of case, but it's just a pleading rule. And so if they're seeking defense and indemnification for claims against them in their official capacity, those claims are against Mille Lacs County. They're not against the official. It's a pleading rule that's against the county. So that's an alternative basis to affirm here, that's a claim against the county that's excluded. And then the other claims are against them in their individual capacity. And as we've shown you in their briefs, you know, they argue to the federal court, you know, that those claims are against them as private citizens with no authority to act on behalf of their office. So if that's true, then they can't be persons acting on behalf of the state in an official capacity, because they're private citizens acting in an individual capacity. You know, the legislature added that word. It didn't just say persons acting on behalf of the state. It said persons acting on behalf of the state in an official capacity. So those are two alternative bases where this court could affirm, just based on the types of claims being made. And unless there are any further questions, I will stop there.
Doesn't appear there's any further questions from the panel members. So thank you, Mr. Campion. Mr. Flaherty, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address a few points in rebuttal, but first, compensation control and subdivision 1-1 and the definition of the state. I have a second answer to Judge Geitz's question to me earlier regarding the state and boards, agencies, commissions, and courts. Courts is listed in subdivision 1-1. And of course, the ultimate power to set salaries for county attorneys and sheriffs doesn't lie with the county, it lies with the district court. And the Minnesota Supreme Court held in a 1972 case, Ziglett versus Goodhue County, that both sheriffs and county attorneys were officers of the court, and that was why a district court has the power to control what they're paid. The county board gets the first cut, that's true, but on any appeal, the final word rests with the district court. So if the panel is seeking a statutory hook within subdivision 1-1, we've got it in courts, because these appellants are officers of the court and their compensation is determined in the final instance by district courts. Now, I don't think that's necessary. The text of employee of the state in subdivision 1-2 is plainer and simpler. And I didn't hear from respondents counsel any denial that the state of Minnesota is a party to criminal cases. And obviously the Attorney General's office has made that argument in its papers to the Minnesota Supreme Court. There shouldn't be any confusion or mystery about that point. It's possible that someone could suggest every criminal case in every court in the state has been miscaptioned forever. That's a remarkable claim. I think there's a simpler claim, which is that the power to prosecute crimes is fundamentally a state power, and the Minnesota legislature chose to delegate that state power to county attorneys and the related law enforcement functions to sheriffs. At base, the criminal power is always only a state power. County boards don't prosecute people, they can't, and they can't control the county attorney's decision to prosecute people. County attorneys in their prosecutorial role and sheriffs in their law enforcement role are beholden to the sovereign. Those are voters. They cannot be fired by the county board, and they, in an important sense, they are independent of the county board. They are directly elected by the voters in the same way the governor is, and it's the same way the attorney general is. And we have the Minnesota Supreme Court has squarely held that they're officers of the court, that the district court can set their salary. And we've had the Minnesota Supreme Court also squarely hold that when a county attorney takes a position in a criminal case, that is the position of the state, and it binds the state. That's the real lesson of the House decision, is the Minnesota Supreme Court in House conclusively held that the disposition of the criminal case on behalf of the state was not subject to review by the Attorney General's office. Now, on the civil side, with the license revocation at issue in that case, it's true. There, the Attorney General's office was in control. But all of the case law cited by appellants holds over and over, in one form or another, that law enforcement and criminal prosecution powers are state powers. And when those are exercised officially, the person or persons exercising those powers officially are doing so on behalf of the state.
Mr. Flaherty, House was decided before the State Tort Claims Act was enacted, correct?
Can you speak up, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. The House case was decided in 1971, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the State Tort Claims Act was enacted in 1976, correct?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
So it's not clear to me how House is relevant, given that the State Tort Claims Act specifically defines the term state and employee of the state.
House held that county attorneys and prosecutions bind the state. The Municipal Tort Claims Act didn't upset that holding.
Okay. Thank you for that response. I just want to clarify one thing. Appellants sought defense and indemnification from the county, and the county is currently providing that. Is that correct?
That is true as of the filing of this complaint, yes.
So this isn't a situation where appellants would not have defense and indemnification if the State Tort Claims Act does not apply, correct?
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, and my time's up, so I'll just say briefly, the band's claims in the federal case have evolved such that that's not totally clear to me.
Okay, do you want to briefly expand upon that and then you can conclude?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. So if a reader just looks at the band's complaint, it does appear that the reservation boundary issue and county action sort of is at the forefront. But as they've been litigating, and I apologize, this is far outside the pleadings in the state court case, the band has really focused either exclusively or nearly exclusively upon this law enforcement function of the sheriff and the county attorney. So the band's case is not exactly what it seems from the face of its complaint. So that's why my answer to your question is a little more nuanced than I would like.
Okay, thank you very much. No, I think that's sufficient, thank you. Are there any further questions from the panel? All right. Well, with that, if you could briefly sum up, Mr. Flaherty, and then we will conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's clear the panel has read the briefs and understand the issues. Obviously, we're asking for a reversal and a remand, and thank you all for your time.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and for your helpful briefs. The matter submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe.